I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The House and Senate are voting on the GOP tax bill this week, and barring any unforeseen circumstances, it will pass and be signed into law by President Trump. One of the biggest changes is limits on deductions for state, local, and property taxes. And it looks like New Jersey residents with the highest property taxes in the country will take a big hit. In fact, economist Mark Zandi said no one gets creamed more than New Jersey from this tax bill. We asked John O'Connor to join us. He's Washington reporter for WNYC and has covered the role that New Jersey representatives in Congress have played in shaping this legislation and how it will play out in New Jersey. And John O'Connor, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
I'm looking at my TV screen and it looks like the House has started their debate. What should we know about what's going to happen today?
The vote will come about 1 o'clock or 1:30. They tend to schedule these things so that everybody knows when it's going to happen. We don't expect a whole lot of surprises today. The House leadership has worked hard to get people on board. There was some initial resistance from Republicans in New York, New Jersey, high-tax states like California, to the bill. They got some changes early on, but since then they've kind of ironed those out, and any objections that remain from Republicans in New York and New Jersey have kind of been overruled because the leadership has the votes to get the bill through.
And just so people know what to expect this week, so the House votes and then what, the Senate votes?
Yeah, the Senate has to go through 10 hours of debate according to their rules. So that means they may vote on it late tonight or early in the morning on Wednesday, or they could just wait until daylight hours on Wednesday tomorrow to finish it up and send it to the president.
And is it pretty clear this will make it to the president's desk?
It sure seems like it. There is nobody in the Senate who has come out against it, no Republicans. Their margin is real thin here because Arizona Senator John McCain has gone home for medical treatment. But they seem to have the votes that anybody who had objected early on to anything in the bill has now come out in favor of it and says they'll vote for it.
And we can assume the two Democratic senators from New Jersey will oppose this tax bill.
As they have the entire process, I believe they will vote against it, yes.
Well, let's talk about the House. First of all, how many, I'm showing my ignorance here, how many representatives from New Jersey in the House of Representatives?
You got 12.
And how many are Republican? How many are Democrat?
It's a 5-7 split, so you got 5 Republicans, 7 Democrats.
And rolling back the clock, when this was making its way through the House, how did Republican representatives from New Jersey, how did they respond to this GOP tax bill?
So the issue all along for Republicans from New Jersey and New York has been the property tax issue and whether or not folks will be able to deduct property taxes from their federal income taxes. This has been looked at by the folks designing this plan. This is one of the biggest ways to pay for the bill. This is $1.2 trillion over a decade if you eliminate the ability to deduct state and local property taxes. So that's a big pot of money that can be used to pay for corporate tax cuts, to drop the rate on corporations, to drop the rate on LLCs and partnerships and other what are known as pass-through businesses. So all along, this was hanging out there as one of the biggest ways to pay for the bill. And the question was, will Republican leadership actually go through that fight that they knew that they were going to have with a lot of their members in the Northeast, in California in particular? When it became clear that an alternative plan to pay for it, known as the border adjustment tax that Paul Ryan had floated, that was not going to pass political muster, that Republicans couldn't support it, then eliminating the property tax deduction became the biggest pot of money out there, basically. When the initial plan came out, the property tax deduction wasn't named, but was very strongly implied. And members from New York and New Jersey immediately said, no, we can't do this.
Right.
You can't eliminate it completely. And that got House leadership to back off initially. So they came back with a compromise, which was to allow up to $10,000 in property tax deductions.
And looking at, so when that bill first went through the House, then looking at the Republicans, and I'm assuming the Democrats voted against it from New Jersey, looking at the Republicans, did they vote against it, vote for it?
Yeah, it's complicated because there's a couple of different procedural votes here. The first vote in the property tax process was known as the budget vote. That sets the parameters for just how much this bill can cost long term over a 10-year period. And so you had a number of Republicans who voted against the budget, including just about every Republican from New Jersey. The only Republican from New Jersey who ended up voting in favor of the tax bill and the budget was Tom MacArthur from Ocean County. And his logic was, this bill isn't great for my voters, but, you know, I objected at first. House leadership came back. They made some changes. And, you know, because, you know, I want to be showing myself as a good faith negotiator, I need to come back and support what they came to us with, because they did actually make some adjustments. But the rest of the New Jersey delegation is voting against this because New Jersey is one of a handful of states that potentially could pay more in net taxes after this bill is paid, after this bill is passed, whereas the other 46 states could see a tax cut. That's according to one analysis.
Well, and as I said in my introduction, New Jersey residents paying the highest property taxes in the country. Did those New Jersey representatives in the House, did they have or do they have clout? Or perhaps I can put it another way, how much clout do they have within the House of Representatives?
Yeah, that was an interesting question. You know, when the kind of nebulous proposal was out there floating, the big question is whether or not there's a veto block among folks from high tax states that could they stop this bill. Initially, that answer was yes. And we know that because House leadership had to come back and change the bill. Once those changes were made, that managed to peel off a few folks in the Northeast. It didn't really change any minds in New Jersey. You know, Tom MacArthur ended up voting for the tax bill, but you lost some votes in New York. The Republicans from California ended up voting for the bill. And so there was enough erosion there that the folks who were concerned about the effect, the property tax effect on their voters, couldn't actually stop the bill. And once House leadership realized that, it kind of became clear where this was heading.
What's the typical, I'm curious whether you know this, John, we keep talking about New Jersey for obvious reasons. What's the typical property tax paid in New Jersey? Do you know?
Yeah, the average statewide property tax bill is $8,500. But averages tend to be deceiving because they kind of mask the things at the extremes. In a lot of places, particularly North Jersey counties and towns, the typical tax bill is more like $15,000,
wow.
$17,000, in some places as much as $22,000, $24,000. So, you know, while the average is $8,500, a typical tax bill may be much higher.
Well, and I guess we're talking about communities that surround New York. So what are they considered, kind of bedroom communities to people working in Manhattan, for instance?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that some of the highest tax rates, the tax bills in the state are places like Bergen County, Essex County, Morris County, and, you know, folks who you know, a lot of them take the train into New York City or commute to Manhattan to work. So, yeah, you know, North Jersey really pays some of the highest property taxes.
And I'm assuming we're talking about people living in probably expensive homes. The mortgage deduction, that's going to affect them as well.
Yes, and that's an interesting mix in this issue as well, that, you know, some of these communities have very high average property values, you know, property values above 2 million, property values above 1.5 million. Some of these Bergen County communities, though, have average property values more like $600,000, $700,000. So, you know, instead of having a handful of really expensive properties that are bringing up the average tax bill, you have a lot of people who are paying a lot in property taxes.
Yeah.
The compromise bill here that the House and Senate are going to vote on makes one change to the deductibility of mortgage interest. The current cap is $1 million. You know, if you have a loan up to $1 million, you can deduct all of that mortgage interest. The compromise bill brings that cap down to $750,000. So again, only loans of $750,000 can you deduct the interest on the principal. That's significant in a lot of places in New Jersey, because, you know, average home values can approach that. You know, so you're, instead of talking about really big, fairly lavish homes that no longer qualify for the complete mortgage interest deduction, you're talking about more average, typical homes. You know, median home sales kind of in a lot of places approach $550,000, $600,000 in some New Jersey counties.
I'm thinking about the New Jersey Shore, and for some people, we're obviously talking about people with some means. They might have a second home on the New Jersey Shore. What happens to them?
Yeah, the second homes are, the interest is no longer deductible. So, you know, folks who own a vacation home or, you know, have a rental home that they might rent out, all of that stuff has been eliminated in this bill as a way to pay for some of these other tax cuts.
Obviously, New Jersey has a new governor coming in, a Democrat, and I'm asking you to look into your crystal ball, which isn't fair to have you do that, John O'Connor. But assuming this passes, and it looks as if it will, barring some unforeseen circumstance, what do you think, especially if New Jersey is, as Mark Zandi said, kind of going to take the hardest hit if this is passed, what do you expect the Democrats and even the New Jersey governor to do about it?
Yeah, I'm not sure that's clear yet. What is interesting is that Governor-elect Murphy has been joining with Governor Brown from California and Governor Cuomo from New York, and they're kind of tag-teaming this issue. So I would expect, I don't know specifically what they're going to do to address this, but I would expect that you kind of see them move together and that they kind of make a plan together and that these states act in unison. We know that this is probably going to have a budget effect, that states will have to adjust their finances to deal with this. In New York, for instance, they've got a tax, what they call the millionaire's tax, that was due to expire. And, they're not sure how this will affect high earners, whether it will make it likely that high earners will want to leave New York. And so, therefore, they might have to get rid of that tax faster to try and prevent the loss of some of those residents. New Jersey, doesn't have the same tax structure, but faces a similar question about whether high-earning people will want to leave New Jersey. You know, if they can afford to, would they want to? And then what long-term effect will that have on the budget? So it's something that is, I think, a complete unknown right now. The other question that's out there is whether or not states, counties, municipalities adjust how they do taxes. You know, do they shift away from property taxes to some other form because of the changes that this bill makes? The compromise bill makes it a little less likely because it allows you to combine income tax and property tax deductions, state and local income tax and property tax deductions, into one $10,000 max deduction. Under the previous version, you had to choose one or the other. It may be more likely, there's some talk about whether or not folks might want to shift property taxes and income tax or vice versa to kind of help the residents maximize their deductions. That's not as much of an issue now with this final bill.
And John, about 10 seconds here, but do you see this as an issue in the upcoming House races in New Jersey?
Absolutely. I have a feeling, healthcare is going to be a big issue, but I have a feeling that this will be a very motivating factor for a significant number of voters. They're going to see their taxes go up, and that's going to get them to the polls.
Well, John O'Connor, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's Washington reporter for WNYC. We talked about New Jersey, the impact of the tax bill that looks like it will pass this week and get to the president, its impact on the state of New Jersey, and of course, residents paying those high property taxes. We're going to talk with Leonard Berman from the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center after this very short break. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. President Trump said the GOP tax plan that looks like it will pass this week will be a Christmas present for the entire country. Here's the president, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin, House Speaker Ryan, and OMB Director Mulvaney promising the middle class will be the biggest beneficiaries when the tax cuts are enacted.
This really will mostly benefit the middle class and jobs.
This is not good for me. Me, it's not so. I have some very wealthy friends. Not so happy with me, but that's okay.
The president was right. There are people who are rich people that are having their taxes going up.
This is designed to be a middle-class tax cut. I think the people who are concerned the most are some of the big businesses. That's where we hear most of the complaints about. But this is a middle-class tax cut, no two ways about it.
We're trying to drive the economic benefit here to the taxpayers in the middle. The folks who are in the middle class, who are paying the taxes, and the places where they work.
Democrats are saying not so fast. It's wealthy corporations and individuals who will be the biggest winners when the plan becomes law. Here's Senators Warren, Sanders, Schumer, and Wyden.
It is the biggest tax giveaway to giant corporations in modern memory. I mean, because that's what this is. Let's not kid ourselves.
when at a time of massive income and wealth inequality, 62% of the tax benefits go to the top 1%. And 10 years from now, millions and millions of middle-class Americans will be paying more in taxes.
The bill is so warped towards the very wealthy, top, you know, the big corporations, mm-hmm. and they want to do so much, it's greed.
It is a big step backward in the cause of making sure that all our people have affordable, accessible health care.
So who is right? We asked Leonard Berman to join us, co-founder of the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center and Institute Fellow at the Urban Institute. And Len, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Are there any rich people who are unhappy today? Picking up on what the president said.
There might be, but they're unusual. The rich people who care about our kids and our grandchildren, they might be unhappy because we're borrowing a lot of money to pay for this big tax cut. But the tax cut mostly benefits very high-income people. Although middle-income people and lower-income people will get something for the next 8 years until all the individual tax breaks expire, and then they're just left with a tax increase.
Well, one of the goals of tax reform, if I can put that in quotations, is fairness, simplicity, and something to grow the economy. As you look at this bill, and can I assume that you read all 500 pages of it?
No.
Okay. But you have a good, you probably have a better sense than most people of what is in it. But does it do any of those things?
No.
No.
It's sad. I came to Washington to work on what became the Tax Reform Act of 1986. If it hadn't happened, I might have gone back to Northeast Philadelphia where I grew up.
Is that right?
Yeah. They actually did consider a lot of meaningful reforms as part of the process, but ultimately they ended up with a very large corporate tax cut, a completely unwarranted cut on what's called pass-through businesses, partnerships and sole proprietors, a very large cut in the estate tax, and then some modest changes, I think, were aimed to win the votes of lower middle-income people. But if you look at the scale of the tax cuts, they all go to benefit high-income people. The bill's not simple. My big challenge in talking to you is if you ask me about any of the details, I'll have a hard time explaining some of them without making your head explode.
Really? Is that just the way tax bills are written, or is there something even more complicated about this one?
This one's pretty complicated because they create some giant new loopholes, and then they create a lot of rules to try to prevent well-advised high-income people from driving trucks through those giant new loopholes and walking away with a bundle of money. They keep the alternative minimum tax. I've written a lot about this over the years. It makes no sense to have basically two tax systems, one where you figure out your tax under one set of rules, and then you figure them out under another set of rules, and if the second set results in higher tax, you pay the difference. Well, they kept the individual alternative minimum tax because they needed the money to pay for other tax cuts that they were adding to the bill to try to win passage.
Hmm. Well, talking about the wealthy, and then I want to talk about the working poor, and I also want to talk about middle class people. So looking at the wealthy people in this country, their tax rate gets reduced from 39.6% to 37%. The estate tax is increased to, what, $22 million. Mm-hmm. And so if you are a wealthy person in this country, I'm assuming adding all this up, you get a big tax cut. And I guess the question is, do rich people need more money? I mean, I know they think they do, but I'm just thinking, broadly speaking, for our overall economy, especially with this growing divide between the rich and everybody else.
So the argument that advocates make is that high-income people are innovators and job creators, and if you cut their taxes, they'll do more innovating and job creating. And there's some logic to it. I mean, you know, you cut tax rates, you give people more of an incentive to earn income. But this thing just isn't – it's just not very well designed to – encourage a lot of new innovation and investment. And to the extent that it does, a lot of the benefits could be offset by the costs of adding to our giant national debt. Right now, our debt is more than three-quarters the size of the economy. It's as high as it's been since after World War II. The CBO projects we're going to have $10 trillion of additional debt over the next decade. Oh. And this bill is going to add another $1.5 to $2 trillion to that. We're looking at like $1 trillion a year deficits for the next decade. And the economy is doing well. There's a good argument for cutting taxes when the economy is in a recession. But we're in the longest economic expansion in many years, and it's just not a good time to pump a lot of additional money into the economy. If people go out and they spend more money, businesses invest more. When the economy's weak, that's a good thing. When the economy's at full employment, there aren't enough people mm-hmm. for the jobs. Wages go up, prices go up, and it could just result in inflation and push us into a recession faster than we would be otherwise.
I heard Paul Ryan recently saying that he's still concerned about the debt and deficit mm-hmm. And thinks that entitlements really need to be cut. So does this create a kind of collision course between those people that seem to think that deficits don't matter, to quote former Vice President Dick Cheney, and those who do care, but this is a bill that increases the debt?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true for both parties that their interest in deficits is a lot greater when the other party is making proposals than when they are. But this bill will, unless Congress acts, produce automatic cuts in a bunch of entitlement programs. There are rules that say that there's an automatic so-called sequester that just reduces spending. And there are some programs they could be eliminated immediately, and there'd be automatic cuts to Medicare. The advocates for the bill are saying, well, we're not going to let those automatic cuts take effect. But the fact is that this will put pressure on all parts of the budget, not just on entitlements, but also discretionary spending, which has really been squeezed over the last 20 years, and paying for things like infrastructure and education and even courts and public safety. There's just going to be less money available to pay for those things. And the president wants to spend more on national defense. He wants to spend more on homeland security. So the rest of the budget, the part that it affects low and middle income people, is really going to mm-hmm. be under siege. Orrin Hatch, who the Republican chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, as a co-sponsor of the Children's Health Insurance Program, he said, well, we want to extend it, but we're having a hard time affording it because we have these big deficits, but somehow we didn't have a hard time paying for $1.5 trillion of tax cuts.
And we should add to that, and I have to say this really rankles me, because the CHIP program, as you said, had bipartisan support, and funding for it expired in at the very end of September. So it's been several months since there has been money earmarked for this program, and some states are having to make some really tough decisions when it comes to this program, which is for children whose parents are not rich enough or not poor enough, to get the kind of coverage that they need for their children.
Yeah. I mean, this is my guess is that ultimately the Children's Health Insurance Program will be extended. Mm-hmm. But there is this kind of disconnect that deficits don't matter when you're talking about tax cuts, but they do matter when you're talking about programs that are vital to the health and safety of a lot of Americans. And obviously, it's a value judgment, and it is for the voters to decide whether those are the right trade-offs. But there are a lot of investments that the country should be making right now. Again, crumbling infrastructure and education, things like that. And the fact that the debt has gotten to be so high, we're looking at $10 trillion of deficits over the next decade, mm-hmm. makes it hard to fund those things. And the tax bill will make it even harder. And there's also a risk that just by the government's borrowing more money, that eventually that'll push up interest rates, and that'll make it harder for businesses to invest. Whatever macroeconomic benefits you get from this bill in the short run would be negated by the negative effects of our debt growing towards 100% of GDP.
That is Leonard Berman. Len Berman apparently grew up in Philadelphia. Always nice to hear that. He's Institute Fellow at the Urban Institute and co-founder of the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center. And we asked him to walk us through some of what at least he knows that's in this tax bill. But as he said, it's several hundred or 500 pages or so. Probably very few people have actually read the whole thing, and it is also very complicated. Any questions or comments, you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me talk about, I guess, the typical American family, what they make between, what, $50,000 to $60,000 a year? Is that pretty typical for a typical family?
I think that sounds about right.
So under this plan, as you understand it, now the standard deduction is doubled from $12,000 to $24,000. How do you see the typical American family faring under this tax plan?
In the short term, they'll get a tax cut, and not everybody will. But I mean, the person with kind of the average person in the middle of the income distribution will get a tax cut of about $930 in 2018, as we estimate it. The interesting thing that happens is that all of the individual tax cuts expire at the end of 2025, and unless Congress can come up with the money to pay to extend the individual provisions, they're actually going to face a tax increase in 2027. And the reason is that one of the provisions in the bill says we're going to adjust tax brackets and other parameters more slowly to adjust for inflation. So over time, that becomes a bigger and bigger tax increase. So the earned income tax credit is smaller than it would be in 2027. People tend to be pushed into higher tax brackets. The standard deduction will be smaller than it would be under the current law rules for adjusting for inflation. So there's actually a giant tax increase on low and middle income people. Not giant is wrong. A modest tax increase that's queued up for 2026. The advocates for the bill say, well, that's no problem. Congress will come up with the money to extend that because these tax cuts will be popular. But the fact is that by 2025, our debt problem is going to be even worse than it is now. You know, debt will be close to 90% of GDP. And it might be hard to come up with the money, especially if markets send an indication that the government can't borrow unlimited amounts of money forever.
Well, one of the things that the Tax Policy Center said is that while most people today will get some kind of a tax cut, there are about 5% of the population that actually won't get that tax cut. Are these the people, as we were talking about, living in New Jersey that have high property taxes and the limit is a deduction of $10,000 to cover the cost of local, state, and I guess property taxes, that they're going to end up actually paying more?
Yeah, people in high tax states can definitely be made worse off over time. In that middle income group, by 2025, 11% of people in the middle of the income distribution would face a tax increase. We estimate about 6-7% in 2018. There are people in particular circumstances that could lead them to owe more taxes. People with children who don't qualify for the child tax credit, which is children over the age of 17, there's a $500 credit in this proposal through 2025. But for people in higher brackets, that's not worth as much as the lost personal exemptions that the bill would be getting rid of. So this is certainly a major change in the tax rules, and there's a significant minority of people who'd end up paying more in taxes, and that group is growing over time.
I mean, wouldn't that be double taxation? You're paying state and local and property taxes, and then you're paying taxes on those taxes.
That's always been the view in the past. The argument made by the people who want to limit this deduction is, one, it primarily benefits high-income people, and it's true that people with the biggest property tax or state and local income tax deductions are high-income people in high-tax states like New Jersey and New York, California. The other is that by allowing a deduction for state and local taxes, it encourages governments to be bloated and inefficient because high-income people say, well, if I'm deducting the cost, it's only costing me 60% of whatever my tax bill is. So I'm more willing to support spending at the state and local level. The other side of that argument is
I was going to say, does that actually happen? Or
well, first of all, there's not any evidence that it happens. Okay. But the other side of the argument is that with the federal government cutting back, particularly on programs for vulnerable populations, they're implicitly assuming that state and local governments are going to do more and making it harder for state and local governments to raise the revenue to pay for the services that the federal government isn't providing. It seems undesirable if you care about maintaining a safety net, maintaining good education, and all the other things that state and local governments provide.
Let me read a comment from Michael. He says, the Democrats' message on this has been a complete failure. Just saying this is a giveaway to the rich has not worked, while the GOP keeps saying lower taxes and more jobs, which resonates with people whether or not it's true. People understand those words. But it is interesting, and Lynn, we're about 30 seconds or so away from a break. This is not a popular tax proposal as you look at a number of polls.
It's not. And I think if you look at surveys, people don't support the idea of giving big tax cuts to high-income people. They're concerned about rising inequality, and they really don't want to cut taxes on big corporations. So the advocates for this bill are going to have a big selling job to explain to people and provide evidence that this is actually doing what they're saying is going to do.
That is a Leonard Berman. He's Institute Fellow at the Urban Institute, co-founder of the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center, and a number of journalists and organizations looking at this tax proposal cite a lot of the research coming out of the Tax Policy Center about who is affected by this tax bill, the winners, the losers, if I can put it that way. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowing, talking about the GOP tax plan with Lynn Berman. He's Institute Fellow at the Urban Institute, the Paul Volcker Professor, and a Professor of Public Administration and International Affairs at the Maxwell School of Syracuse University, Senior Research Associate at Syracuse University Center for Policy Research, co-founded the Tax Policy Center, and that's a joint project of the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution, I should say, and that's back in 2002. A more complete bio of you, Lynn Berman. Let me get Hank from Bucks County to join us on Radio Times. Hank, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. Go ahead.
Hey, Marty. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for another great show.
Thank you.
So my question, I'm a small business owner in Bucks County. I guess before taxes, I'm at about $110,000 for the year. And my question is, how is this tax bill going to hurt me? I'm a sole proprietor, so I don't know if that considers a pass-through company or not, but I just wanted to see how that's going to affect my business.
Well, we can give you probably a partial answer, Hank, only because there's a lot of details about your business that we don't know. But, Lynn, I'm sure a lot of people are asking that question or a version of that question, and you mentioned these pass-throughs. Can you speak to that?
Sure. But I should clarify that I'm an economist and not a lawyer or an accountant, so I'm not giving tax advice.
Right.
But I think you would do well under this bill. There's a 20% deduction for expenses of pass-through businesses, and it actually is targeted at people like you. The concern I have is that there are a lot of rich people who will pretend that they're business owners just to get this tax break, and it'll just be a way for them to avoid paying taxes. But there are a couple of provisions besides for the higher standard deduction and the lower tax rates. There's a deduction for pass-through business income, which I believe would apply to Hank's situation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's there's an immediate deduction for investments in new equipment, but for as a small business, that was already available. So that's actually primarily a benefit for very large enterprises.
What I hear you saying, Len, is that that being a pass-through business, if you're a small business, is one way to get a tax deduction. Did I hear that correctly?
It is. The problem is that It also just creates this giant loophole, and a lot of people who nobody would think of as a small business can end up qualifying for it. There's an analogy to Kansas where they decided that they would exempt pass-through business income from their state income tax altogether, and Kansas's economy lagged. They ended up losing a lot of revenue that they needed, and they were continually having problems with balancing their books, and there was no additional job creation. There were no actual real businesses that started, but a lot of people like the basketball coach, Bill Self, who coaches the Kansas Jayhawks basketball team, he has an LLC, and almost all of his income was paid to that LLC, and he was exempt from state taxes. So he's the highest paid state employee, and he was paying tax at a lower rate than any of the other people working around him who wow. had wage income. And the incentives here are even bigger.
Well, let me
because
ask,
if you're in the top ahead. Bracket, you can save, you know, 7 percentage points on your income tax. That's a lot of money if you're making millions of dollars.
Hank, thanks for calling in. And I guess for anyone listening, for specifics, probably talk to your accountant. Nonetheless, Len Berman has a broad understanding of what this tax plan includes. Let me ask you about these large corporations. Their tax then is reduced to what, 21%? And the promise is that they will take the extra money that they're not paying in taxes, and that will go into their employees' salaries. First of all, does that happen, or is it that the people with stock get more dividends, or do they just hold on to the money?
That's a really good question. The White House has argued that this would translate directly into higher wages, and the theory is that companies faced with lower tax rates and not being taxed at all on their foreign income would make lots of investments, and that would make workers more productive so they could get paid more. There's no evidence that most of the benefits would go to workers. Most economists think that some of the benefits would end up going to workers, but most of it goes to investors, people who own stock. Some of the advocates for this bill have pointed to the rising stock market and said, well, this proves that this bill is really going to boost the economy. And actually what it proves is that stockholders see themselves as getting a big windfall from the lower taxes they're going to pay. Companies already have trillions of dollars of cash on hand that they're not willing to invest now. And this bill doesn't really change the incentives that much for domestic investment.
Does that explain why the stock market has just gone crazy this year? Anticipating this bill?
That's what the advocates are saying, and it makes sense. I mean, if you're investing in companies, and companies are now going to pay a whole lot less tax, that means their after tax profits are going to be a lot higher, unless somehow competition forces companies to lower their prices or something else.
Because it's consumer spending. I mean, if we're talking about the economy, the actual economy, it's consumer spending that really drives the economy, correct?
So in the short run, it's consumer spending and investment. Basically, spending money means that somebody's got to produce more stuff to meet that demand. And that's all of the macro models, including ours, see the economy being boosted in the short term by this big infusion of cash into the economy. And part of it's because consumers will spend money. Part of it's because businesses will do some more investment. But the problem is that the economy is running at close to full employment right now. It can't produce a whole lot more than its current trajectory, even if people want to buy lots of stuff. And the consequence of that could be that either there's inflation or the Federal Reserve has to raise interest rates to stem all that additional demand that businesses can't meet in the short term.
Let me see what Bob from Doylestown has to say. Bob, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you very much for taking the call.
You're very welcome.
My overall impression of this so-called tax reform bill is that it's strong on tax cuts and very weak on reform. And specifically, I've written our Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick twice about an egregious loophole called carried interest. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure your guest knows all about carried interest. President Trump has railed against this. He was on MSNBC yesterday. They had five clips where he said, we've got to get rid of carried interest. And what we discover now that the 500-page document is open, that the carried interest loophole still exists. Mm. And it's I've used the word egregious. It essentially says that wealthy hedge fund managers are taxed at the dividend capital gains rate instead of at their normal bracket.
Well, yeah.
And I just wanted to get some feedback.
Sure, me too. I appreciate the call to Radio Times, Bob. Thanks a lot. Len, go ahead.
Yeah, Bob, that's a great question. The president has been really firm on how he's going to stamp out the carried interest loophole. And in fact, businesses, so the carried interest provision for those who aren't immersed in this thing is basically people are in the business of buying companies, reorganizing them and selling them at a profit. And when it works, the people who organize these deals get paid in the form of what's treated as capital gains under the code. So it's taxed at a 20% tax rate instead of the 39.6% rate that would apply to wages and salaries. It also applies to some hedge funds. The bill not only doesn't change the carried interest provision, so they're still going to be taxed as capital gains, but those partnerships that are engaged in these private equity deals would typically be eligible for the pass-through business deduction. So part of their income is actually taxed as regular compensation. They get a management fee every year, and that can be millions and millions of dollars or more. And now 20% of that will be deducted immediately. So somehow they forgot to fix this loophole, and they made it bigger.
Bob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. What about the real estate investment trust that was added more recently? Can you do that briefly? Because there are a lot of people that want to join us, and I have a couple more questions as well. Go ahead, Len.
Yeah, I'm not going to get into the details, but basically they changed. So there's a rule that says that if you're in a personal services business and you don't have a lot of employees, that you might not be able to get the full 20% deduction. But they created a different way of measuring the limit or how much you can deduct that's based on the value of your assets at the time you bought them. So if you own lots and lots of real estate, you can say, well, you can take that basically gives you enough of a basis that you can get the full 20% deduction. So people who have got large real estate empires or people investing in real estate investment trusts can get this 20% deduction.
Mm. And that, of course, includes the Trump family and others. Let me read an email from Amy. She says, my husband and I are taxed in the 40% out bracket. We do not have a lavish lifestyle. Our four children are in private school. They chose a Christian education. We pay a huge tax bill every year. Our property taxes are high. Why should we give over so much of our income to state and federal governments when my husband has worked so hard? And it's an important question. Len, what do you say back to Amy?
Well, I understand the perspective. I said I grew up in Philadelphia. I went to Northeast High School. My parents barely made it from paycheck to paycheck. And now I'm doing well, and maybe not as well as Amy, but I pay a lot of taxes. And actually, it seems to me to make sense for people who are doing well to share a significant portion of their income so that others can have good public education, have good roads, have a safety net that helps people when they're down. I wish the earned income tax credit had existed when my parents were raising me. It would have made it possible for them to have meals on some nights when they didn't. So I feel perfectly good about paying for that. But that is a decision for the public. A lot of people who are doing very well say that they think they've benefited enormously from the systems and the rule of law, infrastructure investments that this country has made, and they're happy to invest part of their profits to guarantee that future generations will also be able to make those investments.
I think I read in this new tax plan that the private schools can be deducted. Did I read that correctly, Len?
I think you can use a part of college savings accounts now to pay tuition for private schools, which wasn't true before. It used to be that it was only for college. And I'm not 100% certain of that because a lot of the education provisions changed in the final bill, but I think that's still there.
You mentioned the earned income tax credit, and I'm thinking about the working poor under this plan. And I know this gets into the weeds a bit, but I guess it's about being indexed to inflation. So the possibility is that working poor people could pay a price for this tax plan.
Yeah, the EITC will grow more slowly over time under this provision. And one of the, I think, lost opportunities in this bill was that there seemed to be bipartisan support to expand the earned income tax credit for individuals that don't have children living with them. There's a tiny one now that applies to almost nobody. And there are a lot of good reasons to do that. It would encourage a lot of low-skilled, marginalized workers to be engaged in the workforce. If it increased their income and make it more possible for them to make child support payments for their children, stay engaged with their families. And Paul Ryan has supported increasing the EITC for non-custodial parents, as have many Democrats, but that didn't make it into the final cut. There's really nothing for low-income families without children.
I'm looking here at the screen. Unfortunately, we can't take this call. This is Lucina calling from Delaware, but wants to know about tuition for graduate school. There was a plan to treat tuition as income. Where does it stand today?
That did not make it into the final bill.
Okay. So if you are in graduate school, things stay the same for you?
There were a number of tax increases that would have applied to higher education in the House bill, and almost all of those did not survive to the final bill. Mm-hmm. The one thing that did was there's a tax on very large endowments that might affect Princeton and University of Pennsylvania. Most universities are not affected by that.
Thinking, we only have a minute here, but I'm also thinking about that just horrific train accident out west yesterday. Thinking about infrastructure and whether, economically speaking, and sort of for the good of the country, whether infrastructure investments pays off?
Well, the answer is they certainly can if they're well designed. There are lots of examples of dumb infrastructure investments, the bridge to nowhere in Alaska, for example. But we have dams and roads and other public infrastructure that's just crumbling, and that costs the economy a lot. If trucks are delayed on, because the roads are failing, that raises the cost of doing business. So there are all sorts of things you can do on the spending side that could also make the economy grow, and we're having a hard time funding them.
On that note, Linda Berman, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Randy.
You're very welcome. And he's co-founder of the Tax Policy Center. That's a joint project of the Urban Institute and the Brookings Institution. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you for joining us.